This is Oscar Baker speaking. After a long time of making any cassettes, and some time ago we made a few studies on the first three chapters of Revelation especially, and went on over into the seventh chapter in order to get some of the things started. Now from 7 to 20 is a lot of material. And I've been reading that over ever since I was a youngster, and wondering what it's about. You know, I'm still wondering about what it's about. I, rather than go through that and guess about it and so on, I think I'll just leave it with you to read that over and see what you might make of it. I would like to start back with chapter 20. That's after the Battle of Armageddon is over and they're cleaning up in chapter 19. And then the events after the 1,000 years. See, the 1,000 years really begins with the Battle of Armageddon, so to speak. It gets right there before it. And so, in chapter 20, you're coming here where the millennium is over, and these things starting in that comes after the millennium. We sometimes have spoken about a post-millennial kingdom. Well, we have several references that would lead us to think about that, and that it might be a long period, all the way from 1,000 years, maybe to 5,000 years. But that's rather immaterial. It isn't necessarily efficient or the thing for us to do to go into that and do too much speculation. Now here in chapter 20, as I say, this is after the Battle of Armageddon, the beginning of the millennium. And I saw an angel come down from heaven, having the key of the bottomless pit, and a great chain in his hand. And he laid hold on that dragon, that old serpent, which is the devil, and Satan, and bound him 1,000 years, and cast him into the bottomless pit, and shut him up, and set a seal upon him, that he should deceive the nations no more, till 1,000 years should be fulfilled. And after that, he must be loosed a little season. Well, there's quite a bit in those three verses. I read the three together so that you get the sequence. But after the great feast of God, after the Battle of Armageddon, when all the birds of the air come and fill themselves on the flesh of men and kings and horses and so forth, he saw an angel come down from heaven and had a key of the bottomless pit. Now, of course, there's no such thing as a bottomless pit. I think you know that. The word pit is abyssos, abyss. And this is the same word that is back in Genesis where that waters were on the face, or that they, there was a face of the deep. And the deep there is the abyss, abyssos. Now, I would say that in the case of Genesis, where the darkness is on the face of the deep, that that could be the atmosphere, for one thing, and probably included it. We often think of it being a sea, a great bad, well, a lot of water and so on. But just at that particular time, when we see the revolution that takes place during those 6 days that they say of creation, which of course is the wrong term to use, it's not 6 days of creation by any means, only creation on 2 of the days, that there had to be a separation at the very first to start. That was, let there be light. or, to put it real short in the Hebrew, light be and light was. And so, whatever that light lit up, it would have to be the atmosphere, and it had to be the waters too, everything. But at least, before the waters were separated, those from the, in the atmosphere and those on the earth, it could be the abyss, the deuces, and you wouldn't be able to tell which was which. I've been up on the Tribune Tower in Chicago on one of those days when you couldn't see down to the ground very well. And as far as I was concerned, you couldn't tell the atmosphere from Lake Michigan. Made me think, you know, of this back in Genesis when darkness was on the face of the deep. And he had the key of the bottomless pit. Must have been a powerful angel. Had a key of the bottomless pit. Now, of course, a key can be a literal key, and key also is sometimes used in a figurative way. That has a key of knowledge and all of that sort of thing. And whatever this key is, it is something that has a binding power, or has a power of opening at least, a place that is a binding power. And whether it was a word, whether it was an actual metal key, which I'm very doubtful it was, because that wasn't kind of a thing that was unlocking. Well, anyhow, he had a great chain in his hand. Now, what kind of a chain it would be to bind the devil, I don't know. We have mythologies and all that sort of thing. Remember Hercules running across the great serpent of the sea along the seashore and grabbed him up, and he changed his form in many ways like Satan does. And finally, he was overcome, granted the request of Hercules. Now, these myths, don't discount them too much. They have been started at some time on a truth. And like a lot of our traditions in Christendom today, they've gotten a long, long way from that basic truth. We're doing the same thing today in religious circles. Same thing, mankind's been the same from the start, the same tendencies, the same faults and everything. So, don't be surprised. And he laid hold on the dragon, that old serpent, which is the devil and Satan. There's four names for him. No mistaking who it is. The one who found his way into Eden and deceived Eve. And there he was, a great shining one. Serpent. It was not the right name. It's a shining one. He was a cherub. That's, we find that in the history of him as you read it in Isaiah and also in other places describes his kingdom and his throne and so on. And Ezekiel, especially Ezekiel 28, you'll find that. And here he is. I don't know what shape he's in just right now. He has had many defeats. Not no personal injuries. It wasn't exactly possible in one way. But he's had a lot of defeats. I might say that he has appeared, I put that again, in many forms, as he'd changed his forms there before Hercules in the mythological story. And so Satan can make himself look like an angel of light, which he did to Eve. And when we see him as he truly is, why, he's indescribable. And he took that chain and bound Satan for a period of 1,000 years. Now, that 1,000 years is a time of the millennium. And during that millennium, Satan will be bound. He will not be going around as a roaring lion seeking whom he may deceive. He won't be able to use any of his deception at that time. Well, now, you would think, wouldn't you, that that millennium would be a great and glorious time? Well, that's what a lot of people think. They talk in the secular press and everywhere about the millennium's come and so on. Well, now the millennium is going to be just like any other age as far as that goes. There'll be human beings who are on this earth. There will be also human beings who have been raised from the dead. Israel. The 12 tribes will be here. And with the 12 apostles leading them in evangelizing the world. And yet, man there will have his own old true nature. And you will find that the millennium will end up in failure just as every other period has. No difference. Oh, I know men say today, if you put us in a perfect environment and give us a good education and so on, why, we'd do all right. The different ages have proven to us absolutely that man on his own is a failure. And this one is the last one in which man will be put on his own and be proven to be a failure. And with all of the, with Satan bound, man will still continue to sin. Well, why? Well, because they'll still have that old nature. That is, the nations, they'll have that old nature yet. Now, I know that we are prone to blame the devil for everything we do that's wrong. And yet, when you read concerning the nations back in Genesis, especially back in Genesis 11, and the giving up of the nations, and you read Romans 1:18-32, which is a description of that period, of how man didn't like to keep God in his knowledge, and he started to worship things such as likeness of a man, and then likeness of a beast, and on down till creeping things, bugs that inhabited manure pile. And man did that on his own. It doesn't say that Satan had anything to do with it. Man, in his nature, is capable of getting that low. And so we can't blame Satan for it. He will deceive a lot of people, yes, but they'll be willingly deceived. They want to believe a lie. They don't want the truth. And so the millennium will prove this, that without Satan working actively, without the presence of sin in that way, and with plenty of enlightenment and education in those days, yet it'll be proven that man is absolutely unable to walk uprightly and righteously by himself. Every age in the past has been proving this same thing, and this last one here was Satan bound. It can't blame it onto him. And yet, a failure. With the best government we ever could put up, with the best churches and church organizations and so on we ever could find on this earth, it still just be about the same. Human nature being what it is. And we each one will have to examine ourselves by the word and see just how perfect we are in ourselves, in our old nature. Can we come up to God's requirements? Do we have holiness, all of that sort of thing? Or do we have to have something like that given to us? Man is as helpless a little bird in a nest. He opens up his mouth and asks for God to feed him. He's that helpless. Well, I wanted to lay that on a little bit because there's the old traditions about the millennium being a great time and that people will be happy and they'll be doing good and so on. Yet we find that there will be a lot of grumbling during that time and they won't like Christ's reign. Now read Psalm 2 if you want to on that. It gives you a description of his millennial reign. And it isn't nice. But it's got to be proven to mankind that they are nothing without God. They have to be wholly dependent on him. That's the way man was made, that God might inhabit him and work. And without God inhabiting a man and working, man doesn't amount to anything. And anybody has that opportunity of allowing God to work through him. Paul said, you know, that God did mighty works through him. And he was making clear to Peter back in Galatians 2:20, where he said, I have been crucified with Christ. Nevertheless, I live, yet not I, but Christ liveth in me. Paul never could have had a successful ministry. He never could have come out into history as he did if he had not let the Lord work through him and abide in him. And the same is true of all of us. We cannot be acceptable unto God unless he can see his Son in us. Now, just remember that. We cannot possibly be acceptable to God unless he can see the reflection of the Son in our faces. We are so proud of our own works, our own accomplishments, the great things of what we call civilization is about anything else but that. That we lose sight of the fact that there is a holy and a righteous God, and he demands holiness and righteousness of those that are his. And if it's hard for them that are his to do that, what about those that aren't his? What are we also being? Well, he put him into the bottomless pit and shut him up. Now, whatever that restraint is, I don't know. What that chain might be, I haven't any idea. I know that God could speak, and he'd be perfectly paralyzed. But this angel, at least, is given that power, whoever he might be. It might be Michael, I don't know. Michael and Satan have a little warfare on anyhow. And so we can see that. Remember that before this, Michael and his angels cast Satan into the earth at the beginning of the tribulation, about 3 years before, 3.5 years before the 1,000 years began. And so Satan has already received one defeat from Michael, and whether this is Michael here doing this now or not, I don't know, but there's a mighty angel at least. And it set a seal upon him, which just means that nobody can meddle. That he is put under this restraint and a seal put there that nobody can touch him and do anything to him. And also that he would have a label and he'd be unable to deceive nations anymore. Well then, we can see that whatever happens during the millennium, whatever the failure, whatever all of that we read in Psalm 2, is not the result of Satan and his deception in any way whatever, but man and his own evil nature, his nature that he has inherited from Adam. And so during that time, he'll deceive the nations no more, till the 1,000 years be fulfilled. And after that, there must be loosed a little season. And I'll have to interpolate things as I go along. There are certain truths that are common to humanity, to this old earth, and so on, that reappear in the various dispensations and times. And we have to remember some of those things. Now, for a man to be upright, to be morally upright, or any other creature that knows and can think, he has to have a choice. If God man made perfect, so he couldn't sin, he would never could be said to be morally upright. Never been tested. Never been shown to show it. It would never be shown that he was morally upright. No way. And so, in the beginning, God created sentient beings, beings that could think, that had a choice. The first one to make the wrong choice, ages and ages ago, was Satan himself. He was the leader, and he had a great empire on this earth. A paradise, an Eden, gold, precious stones, silver, and everything that was nice. Just name it. This old earth had it. And Satan had a wonderful kingdom. But he dismissed it. He forgot who was his creator. He forgot who gave him all of his talents and knowledge that he had. He forgot his obligation to his creator. He became proud, and he says, oh, look at me, what a great boy am I. And that proved his downfall, pride. Because as soon as he got that pride, he says, well, I can be greater than God. I'll set my throne above his. I will ascend to the most highest place there are, where God is. And I will be like God. Well, what happened? Well, he just pulled a whole universe down about his ears, practically, so to speak, because there was a great overthrow. It involved the heavens as well as the earth. That overthrow was by water. Read 2nd chapter of Peter. 2nd Peter, I mean 2nd chapter. And maybe I better say the 3rd chapter. You check on me. I don't have it open here. And it's going to be a time in which he will deceive the nations no more. And when he is bound, so we can see the extremes there. But he wasn't bound right away. Unfortunately, maybe. Because when he fell, pulled a whole universe down around his ears, he was still on the loose. He could still go about in God's creation. Well, I want to bring in something here that belongs to another study. I hope you won't mind my being a little pokey. But there are things we have to bring up along the line sometimes to help us understand the subject as being discussed. Now, I spoke of Satan having an empire on his earth. When we start in with Genesis, it says that in the beginning, God created the heavens. And of course, there's a conjunction and there, and right away we think, well, now, he created the heavens and the earth all to the same throat. But he didn't. For when we go back in the 38th chapter of Job, we find that there were beings already in the heavens, and they shouted for joy when God laid the foundations of the earth. Get the point? And so there was Satan, ahead of a great angelic host, who had known no sin, who had known no rebellion, hadn't known anything but perfection. And yet Satan, like Narcissus seeing his image in the river and fell in love with his beautiful image, Satan got proud and said, what a wonderful boy am I. Pride. And then he whispered to the angels and said, let's rebel, let's get out from under this awful power we've got here and do as we please. Well, as far as I know, that actually never happened, that he rebelled. That is, brought forth a rebellion and started a war, that's what I mean. It was in the heart. It was in the intentions and purpose and so on. But it seems to indicate that when it came into his heart and into his intentions and these angels, that God took hold of the situation right there. And water overthrew not only the earth but the heavens as well. I won't go into detail. I don't know. I don't know all of the complications in that. That this Eden before the overthrow was without water is rather evident. And there is going to be a new earth, which will be no more sea someday, that will be restored as it was back in the time of Satan and his kingship. Except that in the next case, it will not be Satan, but it will be the Lamb. It doesn't say Jesus Christ. It doesn't say the Son of God or anything like that. It just says the Lamb. And when you see that and get the contrast and so on in it, it's a wonderful thing. Well, I digress quite a little bit, but I wanted you to see a little bit of the basis of the whole thing. Now we change the scene. And verse 4, chapter 20. And I saw thrones. Now, I don't know just what kind of thrones these were. Back in ancient history, we find that men had thrones or chairs, cathedra, or from which you get the word cathedral, where there's a throne of the bishop. In meetings, they had thrones that they cast down, as we find written in the Bible, and those are silk cushions that princes and so on, having a conference, would throw down the floor, probably in a circle, and sit on those silk cushions. They'd be rather high. They weren't just a flat pillow like we think, but probably a foot or more high. And so those would be thrown down, and they would sit on them, and they could, I don't think they lit up their pipes, but at least they could have a conference. And so there are thrones. Now there are thrones mentioned back in the third chapter of this book of Revelation, that overcomers would sit with him in his, with him in his throne as he sat with his Father in his throne. We get a little something of the overcomers. Going way back to where he talked to the disciples, he promised the 12 that someday they would sit upon 12 thrones ruling over the 12 tribes of Israel under him in the millennial kingdom. So here are those thrones and the apostles. And look upon them. You have them named when they're being chosen. But excuse me just a moment. Well, here I am again. Doubtless you heard the phone ring. So I took care of that. I will go on. This is informal anyhow, so never mind. We were talking about the 12 and their thrones, and they were sitting on them, and judgment was given unto them. Now, folks, I want you to be very careful about this word judgment. Now, if they were judging the 12 tribes of Israel, that doesn't necessarily mean they're sitting on thrones and judging them for what they did and so forth. That isn't the idea. It means that they are ruling over them, that they tell them what to do and so on, organizing things and so on. Now, that is one meaning of judgment, and evidently that's what it means here. The apostles were told at one time that they should sometime judge angels. Well, that means that they were to direct angels to tell them what to do, and so on. Angels would be ministering spirits to the heirs of salvation. That's what they're told to do. They'll do. And so these people who belong to the kingdom, that's never said to those of the church, because they're far above angels. But of the kingdom, they at one time can judge angels. In other words, give them directions to what to do in the millennial reign. We have to change our minds about a lot of things that we have been told by traditions, wrong notions we have of many of these scriptures. And here are some of them here, and I hope you will be patient and just dig in and see and study for yourself. I always say, you know, like Mr. Wells, don't take it from me, but search and see. And we just read, and I saw thrones, and they sat upon them. They. No doubt the 12 apostles and any others are given rulership. And judgment is given unto them. And I saw the souls of them that were beheaded for the witness of Jesus and for the word of God, and which had not worshipped the beast, neither his image, neither had received his mark upon their foreheads. Now they saw souls. Have you ever seen a soul? Now come on. Have you ever seen a soul? Well now, I have. Every time I look at my wife, I look at a soul. Souls die. Men and women. In fact, it was told that all of them in Nineveh would die after 40 days. All the souls. The soul that sinneth, it shall die. Adam was created a living soul. That's what man is, a soul. A soul. The article. Well, when you don't have the article, and man has a soul, then that's life. Now, get this soul business straightened out. And so he saw souls. Well, now, in the ordinary idea of souls today, you couldn't see one. And yet we use it just as it should be. I went to visit my neighbors and wasn't a soul at home. That's a common usage of it, and it's perfectly correct. Not a person, not a soul, was at home. But when we get into the Bible, it seems that reason flies out the window and we get all kinds of funny ideas. So let's be careful and be realistic and get down our feet on the ground and head out of the clouds long enough we can think. And here you have your 1,000 years. They lived. And if they lived, it means they had a resurrection. Because they had been beheaded. And certainly if a man is beheaded, he's a dead duck, as we say. But they've been revived. They have been resurrected. Now remember that resurrection is nothing else but a act of creation. Keep that in mind. Now, there have been instances in the Bible, back in the Old Testament, in the New, up until the time of Christ, and up until now, that there have been people who, to all intents and purposes, were dead, have come back to life. But that's not a resurrection. They still got the old life, the old body. But we are told that when we are resurrected, it'll be like him. He's in a resurrected body, incorruptible, immortal. That's where immortality comes in. Not until resurrection. And so we have to watch our terminology with all these things. Now I saw the souls of them were beheaded for the witness of Jesus, for the word of God. They have been faithful to the word of God. And they had not worshipped the beast, neither his image. Now that comes from chapters before. Neither had received his mark upon their foreheads or in their hands. And they lived and reigned with Christ 1,000 years. What happens at the end of 1,000 years? Well, now we have to go on in these last chapters here to find out. But this 1,000 years is the end of this old earth as it is, as we see it today. Not the new heavens and new earth yet, because there's a period after the 1,000 years before the new heavens and new earth come in. In that period, I'm jumping ahead a little bit, Christ will really reign. All enemies absolutely under his feet and perished. Satan too. There'll be no more. And so on this old earth, I don't know how long it'll be. Might be another 1,000 years, might be another 5,000 years. I have been inclined to think of the 5,000, just, I'm saying thinking. I'm not saying this for sure, but I know that 12 is the number of dominion. And man has had dominion over this earth at the present time almost 6,000 years. And the millennium on top of it makes 7,000, which would make a perfect week of years. Now, to make 12,000, it would be another 5,000 on that top of that 7,000, and we would have the finish of man's dominion on this earth, and then there'd be new heavens and new earth. But you can take that for what it's worth. It doesn't matter. I think back in those times that we won't pay much attention to time anyhow. And so that isn't important. But the dead, the rest of the dead, now, let's see here. And who are these dead ones? Now let's get it now. These dead ones are people who lost their lives. And these are the overcomers. Now there were those who were not overcomers. Whether they had really been in any danger, I wouldn't know. We just have anything about it, but there are people who are not listed among these who are overcomers. Just as there were lots and lots of good believers in the world who were not listed in that list in Hebrews 11 of the great cloud of witnesses. And so, you see, we can't put limitations on these things. But the rest of the dead live not. And we know that these have to be believers. Why? Well, because there's no resurrection for unbelievers. They die and they're dead. No life in them. You have to have everlasting life to receive resurrection. You have to read carefully John 3 and John 6, as well as many other passages, but those are quite plain. There's no resurrection, whatever, for a person who doesn't have everlasting life. A seed that does not have life in it, although it's planted in the best of ground and watered and fertilized and everything like that, will never come out of the ground, resurrect, bring forth life and fruit. Never. And Paul has likened resurrection to the growing of a seed that's put in the ground. So if a man goes into the hell or the grave, whatever you want to call it, without having this life, he'll never come out. It's simple, too simple for people to believe. And I can tell you why they don't believe it. I had my eyes open one time many years ago. I was working on a job, but I had to work in a church for part of the time. And I got acquainted with a pastor. And he confidently told me, since he found out that I was a Bible teacher and so on, he confidently told me he had his worries about his Sunday school superintendent. The Sunday school superintendent had some relatives who were not Christians, and so he was trying his best to make the way of salvation easy enough that they could all get in. Now, folks, that's a common tendency. And we have a lot of folks today who are making the stretching it to the place that they believe that everybody be saved, nobody lost. Nobody will stay dead forever. But all be raised and live in resurrection life. Now that's the tendency, you see. But you don't find that true here in Revelation. This passage does not allow that. Even though they're not overcomers, they may have weakened, they had done some things they hadn't do, and all of us do that. Not a man's perfect. It says, for all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. And when you look at who that's talking about, it's believers, just in the verse before. And all those believers have sinned and come short of the glory of God. Don't let anybody fool you. Just read it and read the context. And if that is true of believers, they've come short of the glory of God, what about the unbeliever? Where does he stand? Well, I'll leave that with you. Now he says this is the first resurrection. Of course, that's verse 4 is about the first resurrection. Now really, the word first is wrong there, although we use it that way. It should be the former, because there's only two. There's still two of those resurrections. So the former and the latter. But we're very careless about it. And so we can go with that here. And so there are a great many people who will have a resurrection that will not be resurrected at the beginning of the millennium, but until the millennium is over. Now, one way they'll miss it, miss the glorious reign of Christ, miss his presence, being with him and ruling with him and so on. They'll miss a great deal. And there may be a little weeping and so on when they are raised and they see what they've missed. But we know that there aren't people that are, as we say, lost, because they're raised, have been resurrected, so they've been believers. And blessed and holy is he that hath part in the first resurrection. On such a second death hath no power. Well, now, we have to stretch that a great deal and say, what is a second death? And so on. But the truth of the matter is that there won't be any scorching on his garments or anything like that from the lake of fire that's spoken of. And, of course, that is no doubt figurative, that there was not actual fire, but it's a figure of speech that's the last. Because we do find that death and hell are cast into this lake of fire. And after all, death and hell, a death especially there, is not something that you can burn up like an old garment, certainly. And so what it means is that that's the end of them. And we have, I know we used to have an old expression that we use, that we use in that connection. We'd say, well, my plans all went up in smoke. Ever hear that? Well, now there wasn't any actual fire or anything. It's just simply a failure. And so there is a second death, and it does mean that any of the things that come under the power of that will never, never exist anymore, are done. So there won't be any more sin, won't be any more death, won't be any more grave, and nobody will be going to grave anymore, and so on. All this evil is gone. That'll be, in one way, I suppose, a grand and glorious time. And yet, when we get the description of the millennium, and as we read in chapter 2 of the Psalms, we find there's much to be desired. Now, I think, in adding up my last 15 minutes to my 30 minutes I gave you, that this is the end, or approximately the end of this time, this lesson, down to Revelation 20, and about the 6th verse. Dear Father, we thank thee for thy word. We thank thee for revealing to us thyself, thy Son, through thy Son, and that we've had the teaching of the Holy Spirit to help us to understand all truth. Thankful for this mystery. Thankful we can say that we have been quickened, raised, and seated with Christ in heavenly places. Thankful for all the certainties, the things that thou hast promised and will fulfill. And we do ask that thou will guide and direct us in our studies, that we may be enlightened so that we might understand the things that are needful for us to know, and that we may be able to teach others and help and guide all the folks who are doing this study, that they may just rise a little more in their spiritual life, and that they may have Christ working through them, through Christ we ask it. Amen.